Welcome to the Hoop Collective podcast. We have got a jam-packed show, and we're just going to get to it real quickly. We're going to skip the pleasantries. Tim Bontemps is joining us from Boston. We'll soon be leaving for Milwaukee to cover the Eastern Conference Finals. Joining us from Seattle is Kevin Pelton, who's on his way, his first ever trip to Chicago, which is interesting, but we will skip all that for now for the draft combine and the lottery, which is tomorrow. I'm soon to leave for the Western Conference Finals. So, guys, yesterday, I saw one of the greatest shots under pressure in the history of the NBA, and I'm going to tell you why. Not only because it won a playoff series with Kawhi Leonard, but because there was a 7'2" guy, and there's just been some awesome, awesome photos that came out about this that you can see on social media. There's a 7'2" guy bearing right down on Kawhi Leonard, and he didn't just put his hands up. He was way up off the ground. And as a result, Kawhi had to shoot that ball like straight up in the air. It was the reason why it landed so soft, because he put it like 18 feet high. I know that he said that he did it because his last couple of shots were short. I think he did it because there was no other way for him, even at 6'9", with those enormous arms and hands, to get the shot off. The trajectory had to be so high. The difficulty on that shot, not to mention he was moving into the shot. It wasn't a spot up. He didn't get to set his feet. The difficulty on that shot, off of the charts, Tim Bontemps.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to go down as one of the most iconic shots in the history of the sport, right? It's going to go right up there with the Michael Jordan shot, the only two shots against the Cavs back in 89, the only two shots to ever end a series on a buzzer beater.
We've seen Damian Lillard end two series on buzzer beaters in the last two.
Oh, I'm sorry. Years. No, you're right. I'm sorry. It's the only two shots in a winner-take-all game like that have ended a series like that. You're right. Okay. We've had six total buzzer beaters. Okay. Either way, it's going to go down as an all-time iconic shot, and you're right. Anybody who's watched Kawhi play, he shoots these laser beam shots. The fact that he shot it like that over Embiid, it was just an unbelievable play by him.
And Pelton, I sort of think that the photos of it where he's squatting like out of bounds and Embiid is like also out of bounds because he challenged the shot so much and he's like looking back. And then if you zoom out, I mean, you could have like, it's almost like a Renaissance painting. Incredible. You can go to each person, Pelt. I actually think the photos, even in this era of video, I think the photos enhance its long-term standing.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, it reminds me of the Jordan shot against Utah where you can see the entire crowd in the background. And that's one of my all-time favorites. That was my wallpaper on my computer for a long time in college, even though I have no particular, like, unique affinity for the Bulls or that shot. It was just such an amazing photograph. The other one, though, you mentioned Embiid's contest, and I don't know who to credit this for because I've just seen it secondhand, but there's a shot of Embiid, and he is literally draped all over Kawhi's entire body. You can't see anything of Kawhi but his giant hands releasing the shot.
Yeah, just, I mean, amazing. That's the thing. It was so beautifully documented by cameras all over the arena, low angle, high angle, diagonal angle. And you know, the thing is, you know, some folks that I follow from Miami, I think I saw it from Ethan Skolnick, but I don't know who else also did it. It reminded them of the shot in the finals 2013 when Chris Bosh, basically in the same spot on the court, smothered and blocked Danny Green's attempt to I don't know if it was to tie the game or get the – I think it was to tie the game in overtime. It was the night Ray Allen hit the shot to force overtime. The Heat won in overtime, and Chris Bosh – was in the same position, leapt way high up in the air, and Danny Green couldn't get the shot off. Danny Green is great size. He's a great shooter, but he's not Kawhi Leonard. And there was a lot of stuff happened in that game, Tim. You know, not a great game at all. Kawhi took 39 shots. Raptors were playing hot potato down the stretch. That said, I still feel like their guys came up with great plays. Kyle Lowry with a world-class defensive play, stepping in front of Embiid to get a steal, which basically gave them the separation that ultimately led to them having the last-second shot. And then Pascal Siakam finishing that play with a very difficult, in-traffic, high-speed, under-pressure layup, which, again, gave them the two-possession lead. And I also want to point out that Kawhi missed a free throw, which really allowed Philly to have a chance to tie the game. And Kawhi also missed a free throw under huge pressure in that Heat comeback. So Kawhi bailed himself out a little bit, even though you would never blame the loss on him. He had 41, but he did, you know, not execute that. I feel like I don't know how much we want to spend on the game. Jimmy Butler getting the rebound and racing to the other end to beat the defense to get that layup to tie the game was a tremendously awesome play right after he just turned his ankle. I mean, that's going to all get forgotten to history. It wasn't a great game, but there was a lot of incredible performances late.
Yeah, no question. I mean, look, both these game sevens, right, were kind of typical game sevens. They were ugly. There was a lot of intensity. There wasn't a lot of, like, pretty shot making, but it was just kind of gutted out by both sides, right? And you saw in that game, like you said, the last 3 minutes of that game, the Raptors' defense was unbelievable. I think they forced two shot clock violations, and the third one would have been a shot clock violation, except Kyle Lowry came up with that steal, right? And you go across the board, just about everybody on the court made a huge play. And by the way, in a game where nobody could make a shot, Serge Ibaka, who is not exactly the guy you think of as making clutch shots, goes, I think, 6 or 8 or 7 for 9 from the field. He hits three threes, including ridiculous, like, you know, pull-up three in the corner with Ben Simmons, I think, draped all over him. Nick Nurse benches Danny Green the last 17 minutes of the game for Serge Ibaka. There's all kinds of crazy stuff happening.
It's hard to me to know. Like, I know that so KP, Nick Nurse went with a big lineup. He went with Gasol and Serge. And I guess the concept
Pascal
there
Siakam
is...
And Kawhi Leonard.
Right. Well, phew, that's huge length. I think he wanted to try to take away Ben Simmons post-game and try to take away Embiid's post-game. Embiid was so exhausted. He barely came into the paint at all late in the game. I don't know if that was I don't know what the cause and effect were, but the lineup that Nurse deployed turned out to be a really good defensive lineup. And again, I don't know if it was the Raptors playing it that way or if it was the Sixers just totally freezing up where they had back-to-back-to-back possessions where they basically couldn't do anything, were totally frozen on offense. But whatever it did, it got them the win.
You know, one thing I didn't put together until we were talking about those photos is that Green was still on the bench on that final shot. That hadn't occurred to me because, you know, obviously it makes less sense to go with that giant lineup and you want to get your best shooters on the court, in that situation. But, you know, still I guess because of the fact that he was so cold, he wasn't out there for that one. But yeah, I mean, there was a lot that went on late in that game.
Unless you were thinking offensive rebounding too, maybe a tip back. I don't know. I don't know what he was thinking.
Yeah. There's a lot that's happened late in that game that's sort of going to get glossed over because of the fact that that shot was just so dominant and overpowering. And I thought the most impressive thing, look, Philly's offense down the stretch was not great for some of the reasons you just articulated. The issues with Simmons and Embiid not, you know, his fatigue level after playing so many minutes in this game on, you know, an ailing right knee. But I thought the level to which Toronto went to defensively with that group, with all that size on the court, was just otherworldly defensively.
Yep, no question. Kevin Arnovitz last week wrote a feature on Kyle Lowry and all the things that Kyle does besides shooting. And, like, he didn't shoot the ball great again yesterday, but, like, that steal. And also, there was another play, too, where Kyle stole the ball from Ben Simmons after a missed layup and tossed it back to Serge for a little putback late in the fourth quarter, too. Kyle made a lot of plays like that and was the only starter for the Raptors with plus yesterday. It was kind of the ultimate Kyle Lowry game in a huge spot.
He also did he also say he dislocated his thumb and just
he did.
Slapped it back
or
in?
He called it a sprain, but however, it definitely was affecting him throughout the game.
He said it popped out and I put it back in. So you discern whatever that means. All right. Well, I don't want to rush this, but we don't have a choice. So Kevin, you very closely follow the Trailblazers. You go to a lot of games in Portland. I wasn't surprised that the Blazers won that game because I just felt like Denver, for various reasons, was vulnerable. Although, as I kept saying over and over, I was respecting their victories. I thought it would be Damian Lillard, leading them home, but Damian Lillard basically went and stood on the wing and handed the ball to CJ McCollum in the most important win. And this is nothing against Damian. No one's questioning his ability to be a closer. But I don't know if he was injured or if he was tired or if he just was having an off day or it was a call from the bench. I can't believe that this would be called from the bench. But he basically handed the keys to CJ McCollum and said, CJ, bring us home. and CJ brought them home. He just, his superior conditioning in this series was a huge difference maker. He had more energy than anybody in going, I mean, maybe other than Rodney Hood, but certainly he was dominating the ball in that four overtime game. And then yesterday when everybody was running in cement at the end, CJ McCollum was getting it done. A crowning moment for CJ McCollum's career, finishing that game off yesterday.
Oh, without question. I mean, Dame Lillard's had so many iconic moments, even just within this postseason, but, you know, the two series winning shots in particular, this is CJ McCollum's chance to really put his stamp on a game and have that kind of moment that will forever be remembered in Blazers history. And, you know, it's an interesting point I hadn't really considered about the conditioning. I think the other thing, though, in a game like this where neither team could make an outside shot to save their life, and, you know, similar to what we saw in the Philadelphia-Toronto game, but perhaps even to more extreme levels in this one, the ability of McCollum to create shots one-on-one and make contested shots, it's something that I think Zach Lowe has pointed out a lot. Like, you look at the shot difficulty metric on Second Spectrum that we have access to at ESPN, and you look at it for individual players, McCollum is always up near the top of the league in terms of taking the most difficult shots and still makes them at an efficient rate. And that's the kind of skill that often gets, you know, emphasized or becomes more important in these kind of playoff settings where the beautiful basketball that may have carried you all season becomes so much more difficult to do. And McCollum's ability to just go one-on-one and get buckets, it does tend to, you know, add value, at least as long as he's able to hit those at an efficient rate, because, well, Tim, you know, obviously it didn't work against New Orleans last year.
Right. Well, Tim, LeBron kind of tweeted about this yesterday. He was saying, you know, basically beating his chest it was a strange flex.
Weird flex, but okay.
Yeah, exactly. Kevin's always on top of the sayings. Basically saying that analytics, you know, this is why analytics don't matter, that you need a shot in half court possession, you know, blah blah blah. That's real basketball. I'm summarizing. It's not exactly what he said. Yes, I agree. It helps to have a guy like Kawhi Leonard or LeBron James or a guy like Kevin just said as a shot maker in the half court, or Kyrie Irving. But analytics sometimes get you to the point where you don't need to make a last second shot. Analytics, you know, the Heat used analytics to build their championship teams. The Cavs shot more three-pointers in the playoffs and in playoff games than anybody in history, basically using an analytically driven lineup to help LeBron win titles. It was a strange thing for him to say, but I know his point is you need individual shot makers under pressure. I have to agree. And that, if you want to narrowly look at it like that, that is true. That is helpful to have in these situations.
Yeah, there's no, what is it, Zero Dark 23 for LeBron prior in the playoffs? I guess
that's been retired.
I guess he's now, He's now, giving his opinions on things. But, yeah, look, I mean, I'm not going to get into an analytics debate with LeBron. Obviously, it's a silly tweet. But yeah, I mean, it was like, to just echo what Kevin said, I mean, it was an unbelievable performance by CJ throughout the series. And, you know, look, Denver really loaded up on Dame and basically said, hey, we're going to make somebody else beat us. And CJ did, right? And, you know, that being said, Dame did make, I think, the play of the game when he stole that inbounds pass and kind of did the Steph Curry race to the corner for a three, I think, with about 3 minutes to go, put them up, I think, five or six. And that cushion really helped kind of space that game out down the final few possessions and allowed, you know, Denver to have to be chasing most of it. So,
well, I mean, look, and the
those
one
two
thing
guys, I'm happy is- for... I'm happy for those two guys just getting to the conference finals. They've grinded through a lot of losses in the playoffs. It's cool to see a team that's stuck together like this get a chance to be on this kind of stage.
Right. Now, look, Denver, everybody agrees that their future is bright, although we'll talk more about this in the coming weeks. They got some issues. I don't know what they're going to do with Paul Millsap. They've got a $30 million option on him. But they impressed me dramatically throughout this whole playoffs, but when it really mattered – the Jamal Murray Jokic pick and roll couldn't get free. They just couldn't get free. And the lineup that they had out there, I mean, I thought Torrey Craig did a terrific job on Damian Lillard yesterday. In fact, I'll be interested to see how much Klay Thompson is on Damian, because Torrey Craig has very long arms, and Damian just struggled with him. Not that putting a long arm defender is a new concept on Damian Lillard, but they couldn't get into their offense when they had to have baskets yesterday. They were running Jokic through all kinds of situations. Just Portland blocked them at every turn. I don't know if I can take anything away from that, KP. I was just watching and watching and watching for the pick and roll to work, and it just wasn't working when they needed it.
It was stunning. And, you know, I think it was really just about that lack of spacing, because there were threes out there. They, you know, if they had wanted them, but, you know, it wasn't just even that they struggled making threes. They only attempted 19 of them in this game, which is an incredibly low number. And, you know, nobody pointed out to LeBron that was part of their shortcoming here, is the lack of spacing and the lack of those efficient points provided by threes. I also thought, I don't know if you guys agreed with this, that it didn't feel at times like Michael Malone had the same level of urgency in his coaching as Kerry Stotts did in this one. Starting the fourth, Jokic on the bench, we've, you know, seen time and time again in this series. He was only a -3 in the 6 minutes he was on the bench yesterday, or the Nuggets rather were only a -3. But, you know, I was surprised by that, especially because, you know, Damian Lillard was on the court for Portland, and it felt like Lillard was the player who had been affected more by fatigue in that game and over the course of the series than Jokic had.
Yeah, I mean, I think Malone is both blessed and cursed with his depth. I think it's one of the things that he struggled to do during the season was to define the roles that he wanted to have with his team. But I think everybody will learn from that. It's a terrific series. Boy, I'll bet there were some fans on the edge of their seats this last weekend, not knowing whether their team was going to advance. Obviously, had a couple of game sevens plus some intense series all over the NBA. Now, if your team is advanced, if you're in Portland, if you're in Toronto, you have the opportunity to see your team play for the conference finals. The Blazers haven't been in the conference finals since 2000. The Bucks haven't been in the conference finals since 2001. If you want to be able to get in and see those games, experience that rare excitement at this level, the playoffs, you need to go to Vivid Seats. Vivid Seats is an online ticket marketplace dedicated to providing fans with experiences that last a lifetime. With Vivid Seats, our podcast listeners can watch their favorite teams and, of course, your favorite artists in concert perform in person. They help fans find the seats to those favorite live events, not just sports, but also the theater, those concerts, and more. They offer great prices and an easy purchasing experience, which I think is really most important. And with the podcast code HOOPS, that's H-O-O-P-S, our Hoop Collective listeners can receive 10% off their first order. That's a great deal. How could you not want that free money? And by the way, all Vivid Seats are confirmed, and their orders are backed by 100% guarantee, so you have nothing to worry about there. So if you want to take advantage of this opportunity, go to the App Store or Google Play and download the Vivid Seats app. So first time new customers can enter that promo code HOOPS to receive 10% off your order. That's Vivid Seats. I hate to move off from this game seven, but there's so much going on. We have two big coaching hires, but I want to leave that for the end. We've got one of the most important lotteries in NBA history tomorrow. This has been a huge buildup for months. Not only is there an incredible amount of excitement about who wins the lottery to get Zion Williamson, potentially, I mean, we never know for sure, but potentially a franchise-altering player, the type of player like LeBron, like Kevin Durant, try to think who else in the last 15 years has been really excited. People have been really excited about in the top.
Anthony Davis.
Yeah, Anthony Davis was seen that way. But I, whoever wins the lottery will certainly pick Zion and certainly have a huge following. But beyond that, because of the flattened out lottery odds, where 14% is the greatest odds and the teams, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9 have a much more legitimate bite at the apple here. And they picked the top four teams instead of the top three. The potential for some of those teams in the back half of the lottery to move into the top four, Tim Bontemps, make all four spots potentially altering, especially with so much uncertainty in the market this summer. This is not just a Zion Williamson lottery.
No, not at all. I mean, obviously Zion, like you said, is the big prize, but, you know, there's the whole component of whether teams jump up, they could potentially have a better package to trade for, say, Anthony Davis this summer. There's the potential for, you know, teams like Dallas and Atlanta and Memphis that all have lottery pick obligations or pick obligations that could be, you know, coming their way or you know, keeping or losing picks depending on whether teams jump up or not. You have teams that, you know, have, you know, dire positional needs that, you know, would love to get to the second pick, say Phoenix and Chicago, at least to get a chance to get Ja Morant from Murray State. I mean, there's just a ton of variables. And like you said, it's the first year with the new lottery system. It's the first year with four slots instead of three. It would be fitting if after all these changes, something crazy happened tonight, but, or tomorrow night, but regardless, it's going to be, you know, a really dramatic night on a lot of levels.
Okay, let's talk about the Knicks first. Everybody knows the Knicks win the lottery, they're probably taking Zion. However, Knicks get picks two or three, especially two. And even if they get one, I think they make themselves a real contender to trade for Anthony Davis. Anthony Davis is very interested in playing in New York. I think that's one of the teams where he would feel comfortable extending. If you got the number one pick or the number two pick, Kevin, you're the guy who studies the college the most amongst the three of us, and you're the Knicks, and you potentially could also land Kevin Durant, maybe Kawhi or Kyrie Irving. Do you keep Zion or do you trade him for Anthony Davis? Or Ja Morant, one or two.
Yeah. First off, he wouldn't extend, right? Because, I mean, that doesn't make any sense financially, but would commit, you know, he's going to resign.
Very unlikely. See, here's the thing. Just real quick aside, I don't think any team who trades for Anthony Davis, because he would not extend immediately, I think there's a level of uncertainty with any team. There's no, you're not going to be any comfort. But some teams, you know, like, for example, I don't think if Memphis traded for Anthony Davis, they would feel real good about long term.
Yes.
But New York, I think, would have a little bit more comfort.
Yeah, just wanted to clarify that wasn't an extension. I wrote about this last week on ESPN Insider with the Zion possibility specifically, and it's an interesting question because, you know, let's say that it is Durant and Kyrie. I mean, Durant's going to be 31 before the start of next season. There is a bit of urgency to win now in a way that, you know, Davis coming in right in the middle of his prime gives you probably a better chance to than Zion as a rookie. You know, it's going to take a while for him to get to that level, even if we do think he's likely to get there. And then you kind of trade that off against the fact that, you know, it would have to be, even if you included Zion's salary the same way that the Cavs did with Wiggins and the Kevin Love trade back in 2014, you'd still have to include several other young players to make the salaries work. And your roster would basically be, you know, ideally you would hold on to Mitchell Robinson in that kind of a trade because he's so important to them positionally and because of his small salary. But, you know, it'd basically be three stars, Mitchell Robinson, and a lot of free agents, most of whom were signed for the minimum. So, you know, it's tough to say how competitive that team would be. I think the decision gets a lot easier for the Knicks if they're in the number two slot because, you know, if they are able to sign Kyrie Irving or, you know, maybe even to some extent if they don't because they have Dennis Smith Jr. on the roster and, you know, have addressed that position. I think Ja Morant is a lot less of a need for them than he would be for a lot of teams.
Yeah, but don't you think Dennis Smith would have to be included in the trade package if they're going to get Anthony Davis? So that's,
he would, but then that same thing. If you're trading for Anthony Davis, you're playing to win now. I mean, maybe the 20-year-old rookie point guard is not the one you want handing the keys to.
Plus, you're not trading Zion too, right? Like, it's just easier to trade Ja Morant than Zion in that scenario.
Yeah.
So okay, so the other if the Knicks get in the top two, we got some real action. The other thing would be if the Lakers get anywhere in the top four, because the trade package that they have for Anthony Davis right now is not that attractive. I don't know. You could talk to different people who feel differently about it. At the end of the day, the Pelicans rejected it, and I see no reason that even with a new GM, with David Griffin, or I guess president, vice president, whatever his title is, I don't see it changing. But if they get a top four pick, especially, my gosh, if they get one or two, I think it changes everything. And all of a sudden, I think they're willing to do business. So the Lakers also, I mean, the Lakers' percentage chances are lower, but hell, we've seen it happen. And again, now that spot, which is, you know, I think the Lakers are 11th, I think. Like, the percentage chance of that spot is now in the range of teams like Cleveland and Chicago, teams like in the 6-7-ish. I think the Clippers pick the 1 year that Kyrie Irving was belonged to it. I think all of those are in the range of the same percentage chance that the Lakers have. I mean, yes, it's not likely, but if it happens, it's not unheard of.
Yeah, I mean, it's about the same chances, 9% historically, that, you know, the a team that goes down 3-2 on the road after game five has a winning the series. We just saw Portland do that.
Right. If Lakers got it, Tim, it would be first off, forget about the strategy that would happen. The league would lose its you-know-what if the Lakers got that one or two pick.
Yeah, the internet would melt instantly, and every other team and every other fan base would also instantly lose their minds just based off all the breaks the Lakers have got the last years. I mean, remember, this is a team that three straight years had a top three protected pick and stayed in the top three all 3 years, which is a, you know, an absurd
probability. They've had
at
luck.
That point.
It's not like they haven't had lottery luck recently. They have had luck. Their number came up 3 years in a row, although percentage chances were higher then. The other thing, you mentioned this out front, the Dallas pick, which I think is eighth. Is that right?
Ninth.
The Dallas pick, if it stays put, it transfers to Atlanta, and the Hawks end up with probably two top 10 picks in this draft. Not the deepest top 10 in the draft, but certainly Atlanta, you know, gets Trae Young, has John Collins, has Kevin Huerter, and adds two more good prospects. If Dallas somehow gets in the top four, again, they'd love to have one, but let's just say for the sake of argument, they get four, which I think they've got like a 20-some percent chance of in that top four. They retain their pick this year, and they get Luka Doncic and get a top five pick in back-to-back years, which completely changes the viewpoint of that trade. Now, we can't 100% know the future. Who's to say that they will be much better next year? Their pick could be right back in this part of the lottery next year, but that's a big situation, a big moment right there, Tim.
Yeah, and if you go back, you know, Travis Schlenk recently did a podcast with Woj and kind of summed up what I think he told people privately, which is that last year when they made the trade, the Hawks analytics group looked at the way the league was going to play out and thought the Mavs were going to have about the eighth pick. They wound up with the ninth pick. So that was part of the calculus in making the trade, right? They thought they were going to get a mid-lottery pick. So, they, like you said, if they do get a mid-lottery pick, then it's Trae Young and a mid-lottery pick for Luka Doncic. That looks like a pretty good trade. If, you know, the Mavs jump off in that pick.
Some people think Luka Doncic is going to be a superstar, but yeah.
Trae Young's going to be second rookie of the year voting. And if you have Trae Young and another guy, that's hard. In almost any scenario, it looks like a pretty good trade right now. But if you fast forward and say that pick jumps up, becomes Ja Morant or Zion Williamson or somebody, and next year the Mavs make the playoffs, and are a borderline playoff team, and that pick becomes the 17th pick instead of the 8th pick or the 9th pick, then yeah, that it looks a lot worse, right?
So
it's a huge moment for them.
Kevin, you're the Mr. You grade trades. How would you grade a trade that would be Doncic for Trae Young and the number 9 pick? What would the grade on that trade be versus Doncic for Trae Young and potentially an unknown lottery pick next year, or an unknown pick next year, and you get to keep this year's pick?
Yeah, I think it's probably like a letter grade difference in terms of that. Now, you know, part of it is next year's draft is generally considered somewhat deeper, so you could say maybe you go down a little bit and it's not that big of a deal, but also, you know, there is a value to having the pick now as opposed to having to wait for it a year. That's, you know, why when you see teams trade a future pick for a current one, they're usually kind of discounting the future pick. So I think it is a pretty sizable difference when you factor in the possibility of Dallas, you know, becoming a playoff team as soon as next year.
So if you had, if you could just for entertainment value / the good of the league / what you want to see, which of the 14 teams would you like to see get Zion, Kevin?
Yeah, we did this last week on ESPN as well, a group of us, including Jonathan Gavoni and Mike Schmitz, all made our picks. And I went with Atlanta. I think it's, you know, from in terms of that where he would fit the best and what would be the most entertaining team, that's just an awesome combo. I mean, I think it's Atlanta and Dallas are pretty clearly 1 and 2.
Okay, Tim, who would you like to see? Where would you like to see?
I mean, Atlanta.
I mean, a Trae Young pick and roll would be pretty amazing. Same with Zion and Luka. I mean, I agree with both of those. It would be pretty great if he played in New York. The Knicks fans would certainly be loving a chance.
It would be great for the league. No matter what you think, it would be great for the league if the Knicks won the lottery. Let's just be honest.
It would be. And I also think it would be fun.
And by the way, can I say something real quick? The Knicks are due to win the lottery. The Knicks are due. They've had no luck.
I mean, it's been 34 years.
Right.
The other, some would say that's penance for it being rigged back then. But I would say the other team that would be kind of interesting just from a fit standpoint to me would be Chicago. Because the Bulls would kind of have to just give Zion the ball and have him be like Ben Simmons, kind of. And it would just be interesting to see how that would work. Or if they would do that at all and it would be a disaster. I mean, from like a entertainment standpoint, I think that would be an interesting fit to try to figure out how it would work with Lauri Markkanen and Wendell Carter Jr. But yeah, I mean, Kevin stole mine. I mean, from a pure aesthetic basketball standpoint, Atlanta would be an amazing fit.
So I think karma will be on the side of the New Orleans Pelicans. Anthony Davis demands a trade.
That's the one I forgot. That would be incredible too.
And it would also make a very interesting situation, like, would Anthony reverse his stance? Because let's not forget, they can still offer him the $230 million supermax extension this summer. That offer can still come. And if you are unsure about your other options and unsure what would happen, and all of a sudden you can play next to Zion and have the money, I don't know. I don't know if it might be hard to go back, but let's just see. Let's cross that bridge when we come to it. The other team, I would just say, they've got a very low percentage chance, but what I would be interested in is if the Miami Heat, who are desperate for some sort of talent changer, you put Zion on the Miami Heat, I think it would be a great place for him to develop. And all of a sudden, it would sort of give them a clarity on what to do and potentially could redo something there. It would bail them out of a situation they put themselves in. I would say they have reverse karma that the Pelicans do, because the Pelicans had this imposed on them. That said, the Heat have had a terrible run of injury luck ever since LeBron James left, including what happened to Chris Bosh. So maybe karma also pays off longer term there.
The one other thing that people just should know, just going into it, the Sacramento Kings have the 14th spot in the lottery. They traded their pick a few years ago in the crazy salary dump trade with the Sixers, and then that pick ended up being in the Markelle Fultz trade. So if somehow that pick jumps up into the top four, if it's 2 through 4, the Celtics get it, and if it's the first pick, the Sixers get it. So that's if somehow that pick is off the board when people come up and the Heat are in the 14th spot, there's going to be a lot of hearts and throats in Philly and Boston, because that could be a seismic move for one of those teams, depending on how
right, good point. So let's just say it comes up, because we'll know pretty quickly that Sacramento their slot would have jumped, and as we go down the list, we're going to be sitting there wondering, is it Philly or Boston? Did Boston just hit the jackpot and get a replacement for Kyrie Irving, getting the number 2 pick, or is Philly sitting there devastated, licking their wounds, going to have Zion Williamson fall right back into their lap, which would be
incredible.
I mean, the percentage chance of
that's the one I forgot about, too. It'd be incredible.
The percentage chance of that is really low, but
it's literally 1%.
But can you imagine? Can you imagine, like, as those picks are coming off, like, I don't even know if anybody in Philly is planning to even watch the lottery. They're going to be so depressed from the way this season ended. But, I mean, that would be, man.
I have a buddy who's a Sixers fan who texted me this
morning. This is why this lottery is going to be amazing.
It's going to be amazing. I have a Sixers fan buddy, PJ, who texted me this morning and said, man, that was a 1% shot yesterday, so that means we're going to win the lottery tomorrow. So there'll at least be some people watching it. There'll at least be some people watching it from that standpoint.
The closest comparison to it would be the year that the LeBron lottery, where Memphis kept its pick only if it was number one overall. Jerry West was standing up there knowing you either get LeBron James or you get nothing, and they ended up getting nothing in Detroit.
Right, because if you don't get LeBron, you could have had Darko. No, you could have had you could have Melo, you could have had Bosh, you could have had Wade. I mean, it was a good year to have a top 5 pick. And by the way, Jerry West is still angry. He didn't make the trade, but Jerry West is still angry about it. To this day, he's still angry about it.
Is he probably should be. It also is worth mentioning that Memphis also has a lot hanging on tomorrow's lottery. They've got that top eight protected pick to Boston, and there's kind of three different buckets of scenarios for the Grizzlies. Either they jump up into the top four, which is, you know, the same odds as New Orleans and Dallas that we've been talking about, you know, in the 1 and 4 range. There's a 31% chance they stay at eighth and keep that pick, which is, I think, what they don't want. And then there's a little bit over a 1 in 3 chance that they slide a little bit, someone jumps ahead of them, and they end up sending that pick to Boston this year and get off it.
Yeah, you know, by the way, Boston, if it all falls right, Boston could end up with 2 top 10 picks here. It wouldn't be bad, right?
No, I mean, that is a stick-to-the shot, but it is a scenario.
It is a scenario, especially if you're trying to trade for Anthony Davis. It's that time of year, the NBA's home stretch. Man, there is a lot going on right now. And this is where all the hard work pays off, and we see who's tough enough to be crowned champion. And we see who's tough enough to, you know, win the lottery and stuff like that. It's where players are driven more than ever to go further, faster, and longer. And that's what drives Goodyear to make tires that do the same. Goodyear knows that performance is everything, and whether it's on the road or on the court. So when it comes to choosing tires, let Goodyear.com help you choose what's best. That's Goodyear, more driven. We're going to be watching the lottery with interest. I know I will be. So two big coaching hires, John Beilein today. We'll talk about that in a minute. Frank Vogel, I just want to say, if Frank Vogel had been hired in this job and that was it, I think we all would have said, well, the Lakers did not get their top choices. But Frank Vogel has been a coach who's been successful in the league. LeBron has been supportive and complimentary of Frank Vogel in the past. I don't think that he walks into the room with the same gravitas or connection that Ty Lue would have been, but he's certainly not David Blatt, with all due respect. Vogel would have had to do some work there, but he has been successful in the NBA. He's been a very good defensive coach, which is what the Lakers need. He has gotten a group of veteran players to play together. That group that he led with Paul George and George Hill and Roy Hibbert and David West, there's a lot of personality there. He got them to work together. I think it's would have been a hard job, but certainly not the type of hire that you pan right off the bat and say, what a terrible hire. You know, it's an average hire. You could go either way. That's what I would have said about that if that was the way it went down. To make Jason Kidd, Tim, his lead assistant, and they can say whatever they want about they're not having lead assistants or whatever. Jason Kidd is clearly going to be the lead assistant. I don't care who else they hire. It's like strapping weights around Frank Vogel's ankles. Because regardless of the respect factor, which I think is going to be an issue, LeBron will always gravitate towards the former player. I've seen it over and over again. It's one of the reasons why he had a relationship with Juwan Howard when he was on the staff with the Heat. Because if you looked at the staff, the only former player on it was Juwan Howard. It's the reason that he had a relationship with Ty Lue on the staff of Cleveland. Because compared to David Blatt, he related more to him. And not only is this a former player who's also been a coach who has respect, he's a Hall of Famer, and he played with LeBron on the 2008 gold medal winning Team USA, which was a very important transitional moment in LeBron's career. If you like Jason Kidd as the coach and you liked him, you wanted to work with your guys, why didn't you hire him as the head coach?
I mean, that was kind of my take from the beginning, right? I mean, obviously have a long history with Jason going back to when I was covering the Nets and he was coaching them, but there was this odd insistence by the Lakers that, well, if you're going to be our coach, you have to have Jason Kidd is your lead assistant. I don't know. If you're going to do that, just hire Jason Kidd to be your coach. It doesn't really make a lot of sense to me that you would do this. Your reference to Ty, which you brought up in your column too the other day, I thought is a prescient one, and it does kind of feel like this is the way this is inevitably going to play out. And like you said, Frank Vogel is a good coach who's had a lot of success in the league, and I don't think it is a bad hire on the face of it. Like you said, he took over a Pacers team, was never expected to keep that job, and did, and earn the respect of those guys, and
you know, the Pacers pushed the Heat pretty hard in the conference finals a couple times. But having Jason Kidd next to him, it just feels like a no-win situation and just feels like a matter of time before Jason is coaching the team.
Well, it's just sort of an undercutting of him. And the problem is that we're all going to be watching it. And so, like, every time LeBron even talks to Jason Kidd, it's going to become an issue. And while Frank is very comfortable in front of the media, he's never been in a spotlight like this. Kevin, to me, the thing I see here is I don't think this was a cleanly handled coaching search by the Lakers. And now they've got to go ahead. They've got to handle the draft process and the free agent process. And I'm not left with expecting tremendous execution going forward.
Yeah. I mean, that seems generous. You know, whatever you thought about Ty Lue is the choice as head coach. Clearly he was their top choice and they weren't able to land him because of the fact that they were only offering this 3-year deal tied to the length of LeBron's contract, which also is the length of the contract that Frank Vogel ended up getting from the Lakers.
Which is a terrible insult to Ty Lue, by the way, because Ty, fair or not, is very sensitive, I can just tell you personally, to the concept that he was just LeBron's coach in Cleveland. He was just there to handle LeBron and that he was just there to sort of, like, you know, guide him in. Like, he was a jockey on top of a world-class thoroughbred racehorse. That is an insult to Ty as a championship coach. So regardless of the actual value of the contract, the fact that they would offer him the 3 years as if, well, you'll just be here for LeBron, then we're going to throw you out like trash, that was just a total – I almost wonder if they didn't really want him to take the job based on that contract right. offer. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, yeah. No, I think that's a completely fair take. Yeah, I mean, to me, it's just kind of like there's this clock ticking in the corner right now with Jason Kidd. Like, you know, because something is going to go wrong. It always does. And immediately all sorts of speculation is going to be, well, are they going to replace Vogel with Kidd? It's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy to set up your coaching staff this way in a place where you've had constant drama and presumably would want to try to eliminate some of the drama. But, you know, to me, the key question of this hire is, can Frank Vogel engineer the kind of defense that the Pacers had that got them to the conference finals against the Heat 2 years in a row? Because, you know, when Vogel left, Larry Bird said that he gave a lot of the credit to the defense, to Dan Burke, who was their lead defensive assistant. He was retained under Nate McMillan when McMillan was promoted to replace Vogel. Yeah.
Yeah.
A longtime assistant dating back to when Bird was, you know, the head coach of the team many, many years ago. The Pacers, after a couple of middle-of-the-pack years defensively, this year were the third-best defense in the league, with Burke kind of architecting that. And Orlando, when they hired Frank Vogel, hoping to take the next step defensively, instead backslid under him from where they had been under Scott Skiles and never
and
got even the league average. And then Steve Clifford took over and turned them into a top-10 defense this year with a similar group.
Right.
So, you know, that's, I think, from a basketball standpoint, a big question that will then kind of determine how much of this, you know, drama we have over Frank Vogel and Jason Kidd.
Yeah, I just, I mean, you know, a lot of times people get their third choice for coach. I mean, that's just reality. Maybe it was even the fourth or fifth choice. Maybe they called Mike Krzyzewski. I don't know that. I don't know if they said that. But let's just say that they didn't get their top choice. Again, what's something that I would think is that they clearly were like, okay, we're going to interview Jason Kidd and Monty Williams and Ty Lue. These are our top candidates. And then when Ty Lue turned him down and Monty Williams turned him down, then they interviewed a guy that they hadn't even formally interviewed yet. I mean, maybe they talked to him on the phone, but they hadn't formally interviewed him. Like, okay, go get that guy. And it's again, what was your process? You know, and I just, Tim, I'm just, this next 6 weeks for the Lakers is so, so important. Not just to get the right things, but because you've got a ticking clock, not just on Jason Kidd, you've got a ticking clock on LeBron's career. You do not have a 3 to 5 year window here. You've got maybe a 1 to 2 year window. And so I just think that these choices have got to be pristine, and this was ugly.
The Lakers have been a dumpster fire for years. This process reeked of a continuing dumpster fire, and there is little reason to believe that this team is going to do the requisite things it needs to do to actually turn this thing around over the next 6 weeks. Because you're right, it is a massively important stretch for this franchise to try to balance itself out and do the things that it needs to do to be a playoff team next year in a Western Conference that is unforgiving, as we saw this year. And they, you know, for as much as this process has been mismanaged, they have to not do what they did last summer, which is mismanage free agency if they want to get back in the playoffs. And it certainly, I don't think anybody could look at this process and the way it played out and go, man, I'm just really confident that the Lakers are going to figure this out. Now, maybe they will have someone come to them like LeBron did last summer, whether it's Kyrie Irving or Kemba Walker or Kevin Durant or whoever, and say, hey, you know what? I want to come play for the Lakers. But short of that, it's going to require a lot of work for them to get this done. And this certainly was not the auspicious start to the offseason that they hoped it was going to be.
Okay, so on the John Beilein hire, this was out there a few weeks ago, not public. I had heard about it. I was skeptical that they could get Beilein. Beilein has one of the better jobs in college basketball. He's one of the top 10 highest paid coaches. Pressure to win isn't as high. He's been very successful. To my knowledge, he runs a clean program. I don't know. In this day and age, I don't know if there is such a thing as a clean program, but they certainly haven't been implicated in any of this.
If he's cheating for the wrong guys because they don't typically get very strong
right.
Recruits.
Off the top of my head, KP, I can only think of two recent high picks, which were like Trey Burke in like 2012 or 13. And then Caris LeVert, was he a lottery pick or he was in the 20s?
Wasn't he was in the 20s. Like 19.
He went 20. But he would have been a lottery pick if he hadn't been hurt. Mo Wagner got drafted last year.
Yeah,
but he was also a German kid.
Beilein
doesn't get those kind of guys typically.
Right. So I guess in some way you know he's 66, which I didn't realize. If you'd asked me, you know, before this, how old is John Beilein? I'd have said I don't know, 58. You know, he's been a head coach for a long time. So they give him a 5-year contract. I'm sure they paid him through the nose. I don't know the money yet, but. He was making $3 million at Michigan, and I got to believe Michigan was willing to boost his salary to a certain extent. I mean, I don't know if they could have gone to maybe as high as the Cavs were probably offering. I have no inside knowledge. My guess is that this is going to be $7 million a year plus, I would figure. But anyway, I don't even know if it was a money decision or it was just he's 66 years old. He had some interest in the Pistons job last year. He interviewed for it. What I'm surprised about, guys, and Tim, I'll start with you, why not wait a day? Why not wait until you find out if the Cavs are getting Ja Morant or Zion Williamson? They clearly wanted you to be the coach. You had the position of power. Why not wait a day?
Because I would guess a guy like John Beilein at this point has just decided he's done with recruiting and he's done with college and he's going to try the NBA. And if it doesn't work, it doesn't work, and he rides off into the sunset, and that's that. The interesting thing about Beilein is he's a guy who has never been an assistant coach. He's coached at literally every level. He started in high school in the middle of New York State and went up through community college, Division III to Division II, up to Division I. He's bounced all around the country, and this is like the one
and been
thing
successful
he hasn't done
everywhere.
Yet. And successful everywhere. Yeah. You know, he's had a remarkable career, and this is the one level, literally, that he hadn't coached at yet. So, I mean, he's coached at every level of college, he's coached high school, so to me, this is like, hey, I'm a 66-year-old guy. He, like you mentioned, he thought about the Detroit job last year, probably said, hey, I'm going to get a lot of money, I'll go try this. If it works out, great. If it doesn't, I can go retire, right? And this is a guy, he also, too, has had some health issues the past couple of years. Maybe he just didn't want to deal with the stress that comes with all this stuff with recruiting and all this other stuff. Not that the NBA is a non-stressful environment, certainly, but, you know, you go out and you don't have to recruit anymore. You see a lot of guys leave for the NBA for that reason. And, you know, my guess is, to your point, he could have waited a day, but this doesn't seem like a decision you would make if you were hinging on whether you were going to have Zion or John Moran or not. It said, hey, I want to go coach in the NBA, and this is the right time
really
to do it.
That's a really good point. Kevin, I floated this when I heard that Beilein was gonna interview, or maybe that he was a candidate, sort of the Cavs' secret candidate. I floated it to a couple of people in the league, and they all thought it was a great idea because they think the guys in the league, the executives, they know the college really well because they're out scouting and watching. They think very highly of him. I don't know if it translates. I don't really know his systems, to be honest with you. I don't follow college basketball, but. A lot of people thought this was a prudent risk for the Cavs, at least in the last 10 days when I was talking to people about it.
Well, I think it's going to be fascinating because, so we just talked about, you know, this is not someone who's dependent on elite recruits bringing in the best talent he possibly can, either at West Virginia where he was before this or at Michigan, has consistently had outstanding offenses, and they run a spread pick and roll system that makes a lot of sense for the NBA. He'll love the increased floor spacing with the fact that guys are, you know, spacing out to the NBA 3-point line and even beyond. That's going to be, you know, just heaven for him. I think that there are two real big questions that I have about this. And the other aspect of it, I'm sure, that appealed to the Cavs is, you know, he brings in these less heralded recruits and develops them over 3 or 4 years. So the guys who did become, you know, NBA players, they weren't necessarily considered that when they were 19, 18 or 19. It was, you know, their continued development during their time at Michigan that got them there. The two questions, number one, the defense, you know, the defenses of Beilein teams had never been a strong suit until the last couple of years. They brought in new to the NCAA at least, defensive coordinator named Luke Yaklich, who really turned things around for them. He might be the next head coach at Michigan. It would make a lot of sense for them to just promote him as head coach. But I would like to see Beilein bring him to the NBA and see whether, you know, his defense, which is predicated on very similar things to, like, you know, the Vogel defenses in Indiana, take away shots at the rim, take away threes, and was very effective, got to the championship game last year. I'll be curious to see if he comes with him, or if he brings in a veteran NBA defensive assistant, because that's not his strength as a coach. And then the other aspect of it is, because he hasn't been bringing in these top recruits, he hasn't been managing the egos that he's now going to face in the NBA. And that's where I think that Beilein's, you know, that's what's going to, I think, ultimately define his success or failure, is whether he can manage the fact that, you know, like any college coach coming to the NBA, he no longer has nearly as much power.
Well, we have to wrap. That was terrific stuff. By the way, I think some of the guys who thought they were interviewing for the Cavs head coaching job in this last couple of weeks were actually interviewing for lead assistant job. They just didn't tell them. So we'll see if the Cavs try the Lakers move, although probably not going to hire a guy, a kid, but if they hire one of these other guys that they interviewed. All right, thank you for listening to the Hoop Collective podcast. We will have a lot more on everything coming later this week. Enjoy a big week in the NBA, everybody.